Welcome to the West Peak Sessions. This episode is brought to you by Star Surf and Skate. Opened by surf industry legend Dave Kennedy way back in 1980, Star Surf has long been WA's premier surf shop, and that legacy continues today. Boasting a massive range of more than 500 surfboards, including models from Firewire, Slater Designs, Channel Islands, DHD and Piezel, and Star Surf are the largest JS Industries dealer in WA. Surfboards are shipped with no charge for freight, and if that's not enough, Star Surf is also home to owner Ian Woolley McPherson's epic YouTube channel, Woolley TV, for the best surfboard reviews on the World Wide Web. And it doesn't end there. Star is also the home of MSL, Mandurah Surf Lessons, and many of the coaches work both in MSL and Star, so the staff can help you with all your surf hardware and coaching needs all in the one place. Visit Star Surf and Skate today, Mandurah Terrace, Mandurah, or online at starsurf.com.au. All right, let's get started. My guest today is a performance enhancement coach who has worked with some of the biggest celebrities in the world, including the bands Metallica and Audioslave, Mr. Phil Toll. G'day, Phil. How you going, mate?
What's up, Brad?
Mate, I'm good, and it is so good to see your face.
Thank you very much.
It's been a while. I think we probably haven't seen each other for about 10 years at a guess.
And your face looks older.
I've always loved your honesty, Phil. I'm not going to lie.
That's for great. The crew out there, I knew him when he was just a pup.
That's right. I was a young man when we met. I was a young man with... rock
He's
star.
Still a young man, everybody.
I'll take it. I had rock star aspirations when we met, Phil, and of course I was in awe of you at that time because you had just recently featured in a documentary called Some Kind of Monster with your clients and friends. I'm probably right in saying Metallica, the greatest metal band of all time.
They are indeed.
Tell us about that experience in your life, not just the movie, just kind of a brief synopsis of what it was like working with Metallica for all those years.
Well, it was transforming for sure, Brad, and probably the most important thing in terms of my career was and is that when I look at it in retrospect, when it was about 20 years ago is when I started. And with them, and went for about 3 or 4 years. And the big thing about it was it changed the way I did my work because I really started going to, I went to their turf and worked with them sustainable over a period of time, not the hour or 45 minute sessions. Instead, we would start in the, you know, one stretch, we would start at 11 o'clock in the morning. That was their morning time start, right? And we'd go to 12 midnight. So we would do the therapeutic process or the coaching process for 2 or 3 hours, then go to the studio and they would work on their album. And I would be with them and in there helping them make sure that the teamwork that we were building or helping them reestablish was the kind of teamwork that would sustain them inside of their, you know, working on their album, which was great. So, but the whole experience with Metallica was dramatically a change for me, and personally and professionally, it was great experience.
Yeah, and so, you got to experience a little bit of that celebrity stardom yourself because you featured quite heavily in that documentary.
That's right.
Yeah,
that's right.
So, and you know, I could talk about bands all day, and you know, the dynamic in the bands and all that kind of stuff that you were kind of managing or helping those guys manage at that time. But really, this is a surfing podcast. And I was just having think about it that, you know, you might actually be my first ever non-surfing guest. I mean,
that's a thrill and an honor. I did actually body surf when I was a kid.
Right, yeah.
So you'll be proud of me. So I know a little bit about the sport. And, of course, Adam surfs all the time. He's surfing right now in Portugal, our son.
That's right. Anyway, I've been looking at his...
Lay it on me and, you know, well, what would you like our... the direction for our discussion.
Sure. Yeah. Well, I mean, let's quickly talk about how we did meet because there's a surfing story in that right there. So you just mentioned your son, Adam. He is over in Portugal getting really good waves by the looks of his Instagram page. So that experience for me was interesting because I'd been living and working in Russia for 6 months and hadn't been surfing at all. And,
you know, kind of got tired of the industry that I was in at that time, the oil and gas business, and decided to take the cash that I'd made there and go on a surfing trip around Indo. And I arrived and, you know, I got told by the taxi driver at the airport that it was 10 foot at Uluwatu, and my heart started beating and, you know, a little bit out of shape. Went and bought myself a gun from a surf shop in Kuta, and when I got to Uluwatu and stood in the cave, I remember being like, okay, this is serious. This is big, right? This is not the biggest waves I've ever been in, but certainly a memorable session. And I paddled out in the surf, and I was a little bit reluctant at first. I remember going to take off on one of the first waves in the set, and this little blonde Californian kid screaming at me to go, 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 and I couldn't quite get into it, and turned around and just saw this thing looming down on me. And long story short, I guess my leg rope broke, and I took 10 waves on the head, and I was vaguely aware of this guy that was also getting beaten alongside of me. And I just remember him looking at me, you know, realized that I didn't have a board and I was swimming, and in his thick Californian accent says, "You okay, dude?" And I was like, "Yeah, I'm all right, mate. I just got some swimming to do."
That's a great story.
Yeah, and that was Adam. And then the next day, and the kid that called me into the wave was Adam's friend Carl. So the next day we jumped on the bus to go to G-Land, and there they were, and lifelong friendships were forged, and
of course,
and here we are. So in terms of what I want to ask you, I mean, I talk a lot on this podcast, you know, I interview professional surfers and kind of surf celebrities from around the traps, and you know, we often talk about, you know, the trappings of fame and celebrity, and you know, what surfers go through when they retire from professional sport. And I know that you've worked with a lot of professional sports people, and you know, that can be a really difficult, dark time for those guys, you know, and just kind of that whole, you know, trying to transition from a life of sort of fame and stardom, and you know, you think you're going to be young and forever and the money's going to come forever, and then all of a sudden the rug's pulled out from under you, and that's, you know, a real stark transition and really hard to deal with. Now, I know that nowadays in professional surfing, they get a lot more support. But some of the guys that I talk to are, you know, stars from the 80s and 90s and, you know, retired at a time when there really wasn't any support, and they just had to find their way, you know, and there's been a lot of mental health casualties along the way as a result of that kind of thing. But what's your sort of experience in that, you know, professional sports people and celebrities' careers coming to an end and then kind of having to fall off that cliff from superstardom almost into like back to the normal life like the rest of us?
Well, what comes to mind is we were talking about Metallica before. Kirk Hammett told me one time, "Phil, I have PTSD." Now, he's still performing and performing, you know, well, and they're going to go on until they fall, right? And they won't fall for the music because they're sustaining themselves. But Kirk said, "Phil, I'm suffering from PTSD. And I said, "What are you talking about, Kirk?" And he said, "Because when I come home off of tour, I have to be a normal husband, and you know, I have to do stuff around the house."
Yeah.
And I said, "Well, first of all, you don't have to do any stuff around the house, Kirk. But given the fact that you're concerned about it, because it's an adjustment." What he meant was it's an adjustment. When you're adored by 80,000 fans, right? Yeah. Now, surfers aren't, generally speaking, adored live at doing a tour where there's 80,000 fans on the beach. Mm. But you get the high. First of all, you get the surfing high, which is a remarkably unique high.
Yeah.
And you couple that with the attention you get and the life you lead with that. And when you all of a sudden, like you say, don't have that anymore, what are you going to replace it with?
Yeah.
And it's in some ways, the intoxication of whether it's the fame or the exhilaration of the experience of what you're doing in your life is different than an 8-to-5 job means that there's a larger fall off the cliff, to quote you.
Yeah.
Okay. And so a person has to manage their mind. They have to, I call it domesticating the mind. We have to learn at this stage of life not to get seduced by the intoxication. It's an addiction. Not to get seduced by the addiction to the point where we're unprepared when it's over.
Yeah.
And when it's over, the fall will be greater if we haven't prepared for that.
Yep.
And it's so exhilarating and intoxicating, the physicality of the sport, catching a wave, you know, it, beyond what fame you associate with it or money you make from it. Because not, you know, I'm talking about every surfer out there.
Yeah.
When you can no longer surf, you know, and you can go for a long period of time surfing, okay? But there's nothing, I've never talked to a surfer that does, who has not said, there's nothing to compare this, that nothing else that I do or have done that compares to this.
Exactly.
So if you have that kind of unique place where you go to get high on life, let alone whatever else you're on, and the exhilaration that comes with it, like we're talking about, you must prepare for that. You'd be smart to prepare for that now. So how do you prepare for it?
Yeah.
Okay, everybody is unique, but everybody has a mind and can discipline themselves if they choose to do it. And one of the things we're dealing with here is not to get seduced by something external that you're dependent upon. Okay. And that can be any kind of athlete. That can be a musician. That can be, frankly, an accountant who is intoxicated by the rituals of the day-to-day adding up numbers, or somebody who gets, whose ego is stroked as a businessman who has a winning combination as an entrepreneur. Or, you know, anybody can get high off of whatever it is that they're attached to. So for everybody listening to this program, it's wise to take stock and to go, so what is there anything that I'm addicted to? Could be food, it could be booze, it could be drugs, it could be a lifestyle, it could be a thought process, it could be a belief system. Anything that we're overly attached to makes us vulnerable, especially when we no longer can, you know, where ideas change or where ideas are defeated, or you know, our position in life changes, or something dramatic happens to us that takes us down a pathway we weren't prepared for. Just like a football player in America has to call an audible, a quarterback calls an audible at the line of scrimmage. You learn to audibleize it. If you learn to audibleize in life, that means you approach a moment with some preparation. But a surfer, when they're catching a wave, has to audibleize when they're catching a wave to be able to adjust to whatever the wave is telling. The wave dictates.
Yeah.
And then the human being accommodates that. So there are certain life lessons that surfing teaches. So if we're talking about the afterlife of the surfer.
Yeah.
It's important to start while when we're young, it's important to start disciplining our mind. And make sure that we work. The people that I've worked with who have been famous, that have struggled, have never brought their personalities up to the place where they can accommodate the fame or the lifestyle.
Yeah. Yep.
And fame isn't taught in school, and there isn't a lot of self-mastery, psychological self-mastery that's taught in schools either.
Yeah.
So that's a long-winded answer to your question. You can edit that whatever way you want.
It's a great answer. I don't think I'll edit it at all, because I think there's a great lesson in there for everybody. And I think, you know, the your reference to, you know, parallels between surfing and life, it's interesting you should say that, because literally the last podcast interview I did was with the great Sean Thompson, 1977 world champion from South Africa. He's been through a heck of a lot in his life, including losing a son. And he spoke on my podcast about what he did to help him overcome that, you know, that horrible grief. And one of the things that he does now is he travels around, you know, all kinds of places, from corporations to prisons and schools and all kinds of things. And he introduces his clients, or his, you know, the people fortunate enough to be listening to Sean, something that he calls the Surfer's Code. And it's, you know, it's what surfing taught him, you know, the lessons that he learned from surfing that he can take into his life. And I'm sorry, I'm not an expert, but I know that he has people write down 12 lines that start with "I will," you know, and it becomes their code for how they, take on life's challenges and stuff like that. So wonderful to see someone like him that suffered such a loss. Turn that around, and he used surfing to help him do that, and now he's out helping other people. What a wonderful man. So, and thanks, man. And that's awesome. And like, so just quickly, I mean, I do have some listeners in America, particularly around California, and I'm sure Adam listens religiously as well. And so famous sports people that you, are you working with athletes that Americans would know right now, like footballers and people like that, that you're able to?
Well, most of the clients right now, interestingly enough, are business clients and, right. and entrepreneurs. And it's kind of business, sports, and entertainment have been, you know, so the range of primary, if I were to group the clients and the people.
Yeah.
But I don't have any like name drops to give you at this particular point in time that would mean much to the audience.
Yeah.
What I think the audience may want to if their audience is looking for references like Sean Thompson or people that have established as role that are your role models in your sport. Look at why you like that person. Anybody we idolize is a mirrored reflection of something about ourselves that we admire. Our objective is not to over attach to become dependent upon them as role models as much as use their what it is we really appreciate about them or appreciate about ourselves inside of them as our own incentive to be the best Brad Sterling or the best Phil Toll.
Yeah.
And so our idols are one of the ways, one of the things that happens in the world is that we over idolize our famous people.
Yeah.
And we burn them up and, you know, we chew them up and spit them out after yeah. when we're done with them.
Yep.
And so an awful lot of famous people that you and I know or know about.
Yeah.
Don't recover from what we've described as the side effects of fame, the distortion of that, you know, of being worshipped by people, not because of who we are,
yep.
but because who they think we are or what we mean to them.
Yeah.
Yep. So again, it you know, if we're looking at Sean Thompson, we want to take the messages back that are relevant to us. And we want to, one of the things you started to say that I think is really important about him is, I think, I don't know, but what you started to say is when we give to other human beings, when we give to other human beings, we get in some ways our greatest satisfaction.
Yeah.
When you describe the surfing situation with Adam, when you met him for the first time and you were thrashed by the waves, you know, I think it was more than one wave, and Adam was there, he was your friend and he was supporting you. And,
yeah.
And surfing is a great camaraderie sport, or it could be also a violent sport where people are stealing waves from one another, or they have their own surf territories, right? The locals
yeah.
control stuff like that. That's a selfish way of approaching life. But surfing at its best is a shared common bond that people get from the mutual experience together.
Yep. Absolutely. I love that, mate. You know, and I think you're absolutely right. I mean, I think as the world gets more and more populated and, you know, waves are essentially a resource like any other resource that human beings kind of consume for our own benefit. And I think, you know, surfing lineups around the world becoming more and more crowded, more and more dangerous. And there seems to be, you know, perhaps increasing hostility as well, which is quite disturbing to see. And I can imagine for people like Sean that have been around for so long, you know, they've kind of seen surfing in the Western world from its inception almost to the modern day. And, you know, a lot's changed. And, you know, people see photos now on Instagram of the guys like Sean and Ian Cairns is another friend of mine that I talk to quite regularly that, you know, five or six guys on a wave at Waimea and they make comments on Instagram like, you know, who are these assholes dropping in on you? And it's like, that's not what's happening. This is five guys, you know, that are a handful of people that have ever even surfed Waimea Bay other than, you know, the Hawaiian locals that surfed it for a long time. They're sharing an experience. They're dropping into the same wave together on purpose. You know, so it's interesting how that the sport has changed and that hostility, unfortunately, is creeping in. And it would be good to see somehow, I don't know, a forced return to some of those earlier values where it should be that communal, you know, shared experience in the water.
Yeah, I mean, as far as I know, nobody owns the water, right? Literally, there's, you know, there've been people over the history of man who've tried to buy or resorts are trying to own parcels of water, yeah. but you can't own the ocean, right? So the ocean belongs to everybody, right? Yeah. Theoretically. And I understand how locals want to feel about that.
Yeah.
When you think, what are some questions in the remaining time that we have, and I got to split a little bit here, what are some questions you think your audience would like me to address?
Yeah, well, I think,
what we talked about.
There's so many, and we might have to do a part two of this at some point, Phil. But the one that's, I'm doing a bit of kind of research at the moment for a project that's historical, and it's looking at some characters that are, these kind of icons of rebellion in surfing, because, surfing's been on this journey from, ancient Hawaiian sport. It was brought to America by a fella called Huntington, who was all about making money, and Huntington Beach is named after him, and he brought surfing as a way to essentially sell land in Southern California, and it became this commercialized entity with Gidget and the Beach Boys and all that stuff at the end of the 60s, and then in the 80s, in the 70s, it became something that, surfers were kind of frowned upon by society because they were seen as, these draft dodgers layabouts that wouldn't get a job and contribute to normal society. And, it goes on from there. In the 80s, it became, aggressive and rock and roll and all this stuff. And nowadays, it's as mainstream as it could ever be. But I think because it's so mainstream now, it's quite fascinating, I think, to the people that, listen to my podcast and read some of the things that I write, that to try and imagine what it was like in the 70s when surfers were outcasted. And, there's some real figures that are cultural sort of icons that stand out from that time. And I'll give you a couple of names. So Mickey Dora is a classic from Malibu, who essentially went on a lot, he went down a dark path and went into a life of crime. Where he was forging credit cards to pay for flights to Hawaii. And, basically all he was trying to do is fund a life where he could just surf every single day.
Sure.
And he was a very talented surfer, but professional surfing was in its absolute inception. So there was no clear path that, I could become a professional surfer and make a living that way. So he went down a life of crime. And it's always fascinated me those people that are prepared to just kind of roll the dice and risk everything and live in a complete, a direction that's completely counter to the rest of society. But by all reports, the personality that he fostered in doing that, he was a prick. He was an asshole to everybody. Mm-hmm. I know you probably, I haven't given you any time to prepare or do any research or try to understand Mickey in particular, but I'd love to know if you could offer any maybe insights into that kind of mindset that's so addicted to this thing called surfing that they're prepared to live completely counter to society and risk they're chasing a life of freedom, but they're prepared to risk their freedom and end up in jail by living a life of crime. Any kind of commentary that springs to mind listening to that?
Well, are there any criminals out there watching our podcast right
I'm not
now?
Sure. They'd have to be, wouldn't they? Well, I'm hoping my numbers are so high.
I think the way I do... my work is psychology, and I have compassion for someone like that. I don't feel like his intention was criminality, but his addiction is no different than somebody who needs to sell themselves for coke, or they have to steal for coke, or in their mind because they're hooked on something.
Right.
And a lot of times, addictions, the ones that stand out are gambling, drugs, sex, there are booze. The addictions take over our lives, and they become compulsions. And they're not really enjoyed in the way that we think they are, because it's such great cost to the human personality when that happens. Okay, so I don't think those guys are probably like what you're talking about are. Heroes to some of us because they stand up. They're saying, "This is what I want my life to be, and nobody's going to stop me from it." Mavericks, right? And I admire that part of it. But I think again, it's deceptive. I think we don't understand the psychological price that someone like that does pay. I'm not even talking about when they get caught or mm-hmm. something, if they're living the life of crime.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think that one of the things that I've heard myself say today that probably is important to reinforce is that all of us are prone to addiction, and addiction is something that eventually controls us. And it doesn't. It no matter how pleasurable it seems to be, it becomes an escape from something more than a pleasure.
Yeah.
It becomes a pseudo pleasure, and it may feel like it temporarily. But most people, when I've worked with people who have addictions, when they're that addicted, they need rehab. And when they're that addicted, they aren't really enjoying what they are wanting to do regularly. They're just compelled to do it.
Yeah.
So bless him. We're, you know, so someone like that. A lot of our role models, famous people, teach us what not to do.
Yeah.
Or teach us some you know, teach us to you know, a good role models for what we ought not to do.
Yeah.
So give me a wrap up before I go. Is there anything else that you're thinking about?
Oh, look, there's so much we could talk about. I do want to get you back on the show again someday when you can spare another half hour. It's been wonderful, mate. You're always a man that's so full of wonderful insights, and it's almost impossible to have a conversation with you without going somewhere really, really deep. And every time I've spoken to you, it's been that way, and I always get something out of it, Phil. And I know how busy you are. I also know how much money people usually pay for about half an hour of your time, mate. So I really appreciate you giving up your time.
No, thanks, Brad. But, you know, it's the interviewer, too. And you we're friends. But for the people who don't have our friendship with you, level of friendship, you know, I know you to be someone who I love the fact that you take risks, constructive risks with yourself, and you pursue the upside of your personality, and you are an adventurer, like we were talking about before the program started. And I think there's an adventurous part to all of us. And I think one of the things I admire about you, and I admire about surfing, is that it's something that people do. It doesn't have to be done in moderation. The commitment that people have to surfing is a testimony to people wanting to find out something about themselves, to explore the outer limits of their personality, the outer limits of their physicality, the outer limits of themselves. And they aren't willing to be, to settle for comfort. The first 9 months are in the womb where everything is taken care of. The rest is an adventure.
Yeah.
And there is a psychological compulsion to return to the womb. That's why if you examine your lives, some of you out there, some of you are living, trying pseudo adventure, but compromising the upside potential of your adventurous possibilities by staying safe and playing it safe. And that's the dreaded alternative that can be worse than in some ways than going for it all and failing. So love you, Brad. And great to talk with you, man.
Audience
out there, it's a pleasure, and hope everybody got a little bit of something out of this, and we'll see you again soon.
Fantastic, Phil. Thanks so much for your time, mate.
Just a quick reminder that this episode was brought to you by Star Surf and Skate. For all your surf hardware and coaching needs, visit Star Surf and Skate today, Mandurah Terrace, Mandurah, or online at starsurf.com.au. Thanks, and see you next time.